guy said, but you know, this Prost is a you know? I put the card in my pocket and I said, okay.
Welcome back to my podcast, Beyond Victory. And today I'm very proud because my guest is Alain Prost, who is one of the most successful Formula One drivers of all time, four-time world champion, and of course, the legendary battle with Senna. So we're really going to dive into some of those intricacies, and I think it's going to be a very, very inspirational talk, hopefully. Okay, Alain, thank you so much for joining my podcast. I've been trying to ask you so kindly to join for like years and years and years, and I've been annoying you and pestering you with SMS. So I really apologize, but I'm so happy that you're taking the time now. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you. You know, at the end, we do it. So with a great pleasure, Nico.
Yeah. And of course, you're, I mean, one of the most successful Formula One drivers of all time, four-time champion, four-time runner-up, 51 wins. So incredible career. So that's why, of course, it's a great pleasure. And now I am an expert of your career, even more so than before, because I spent all the way until 1:30 at night last night studying the career of Alain Prost and all the details and everything. So now I know quite a lot. And for example, one thing that I found really nice was that you spoke, I mean, one of the most positive things about all your comments was actually about my dad and about that year of 1986.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's, you know why? Because I'm sure we're going to talk about the rivalry between the drivers, you know, when your team met and things like this, you know, but when KK arrived, when your dad in the team or just before, we already had some comments that, you know, because KK had a very different style than mine, and he's going to beat me, he's going to destroy me or whatever, you know, but the most important is the relation between the two because of different characters and nationality, you know, it's going to be odd. But at the end, it was maybe one of my best year with the teammate. Going back to the 86, at the end of the year, the last race, I've been world champion because of our relation for two reasons. The first reason is the ambience in the team was at the best in 86. Because we really work well together. And our car was much less good than the Williams and Honda engine. But we keep going and trying to get the best until the last race. But the last race, we have decided to have a different strategy. And KK had some problems with the tires, but mainly with the brakes also. To make the story short, KK played the game, you know. So I've been world champion really because of that. And that is really a good in the history of Formula One when you're teammates. It's not only fight or, rivalities, it's also friendship, also the benefit for the team.
Yeah, of course. But that's very nice to hear that you had such positives about my dad. But saying that, I mean, it also was a bit easier because he struggled so much with the understeer that he couldn't really be your rival that year. So, of course, that also makes the situation a little bit easier.
Yeah. Exactly. You don't know what is happening. But even with KK, even with Ayrton the first year in 88, we had a very good relation. And he beat me. He had one more race only, but one more win. But we had a good relation. So you can have, but it's very difficult on the long term. If you are fighting only yourself, like you did with Lewis, with nobody can beat you, no other cars, no other drivers can beat you. Or if you have another guy in the middle, like we had in 84 with Nelson, for example, when I was with Nicky. It's a different... we all come back to the psychology also at the end. We're going to talk about that for sure.
Yeah, let's jump back to a chronological order. I'd like to jump back to the beginning. So, of course, you got into Formula One very young. And what was your first, like, it was a big roller coaster for you in the beginning of your Formula One career, also mentally. So what was your first big, big positive highlight that you experienced in your Formula One career?
Well, the first positive highlight was the test I've done at the end of 79 before I arrived in Formula One. Because, in fact, I came to Watkins Glen and Canada, the last races of Formula One races. And McLaren proposed to me a drive, you know. And I refused it because I said, you know, I cannot drive Formula One, especially at Watkins Glen. We make a test where you want in Europe, but I need to be more prepared. And then they planned the test in Ricard, but I got the information maybe 3 weeks after the last race. So it's not like today, you know, when we had the mobile phone, the thing like this, the communication was not like this at the time. So I was sure that I was finished because I had no other program. So I was almost ready to go back to work with my father and doing something different. And then I had this test, you know, with Kevin Cogan and Patrick Tambert, he was there. But yeah, that was the first highlight, you know.
Were you fast?
I was really fast. I was really fast. I must say that, you know, sometimes, you know, when you're talking about highlight, but it's more that you remember sometimes. I got in the car, you know, when you got first time in the car, in Formula One car, coming from Formula 3, it's like a big... big one, you know. I said, and I'm going to be able to drive this kind of car, you know, with so much power. At the time, it was only 500 horsepower, not more, even a little bit less. And then you do one lap, you know, a bit slow, second lap, a little bit quick. And the third lap, you realize that I'm going to do it. I feel well, you know. And that's the first thing I remember. I was sure after three laps that I would be very good, very, very fast. I was convinced.
And then you switched to Renault, and the next big highlight was winning your home Grand Prix in the first year with Renault, where you then say a comment also, and you say, when it works, you are God. Yeah. That's how you felt as well in that moment?
I always felt that. I still feel it for other people or the sportsmen or whatever, or even not, or even outside sport. I mean, when you win, I mean, you're like God because you can say, if you win and you're strong, you can say everything, even if it's, you know, the people, they listen to you. And otherwise, it's part of the game, you know. But yeah, going back to winning the first race, it's a strange feeling because it's not the moment that I remember the most, you know. It's like, you need to have a first time, you know, but that was the first time. It was in France, it was with a French team. But it did not have the repercussion that I could imagine, you know. But it was really like first step, and then I had to find something else. But it was a very difficult time at Renault 81, 82, 83, because...
Can I interrupt you there? I interrupt you because you say the difficult time. I just wanted to mention a few quotes that you said about this difficult time before you explain it. So you said, it was the worst situation of my life. It's incredible how much you can suffer when you are in the spotlight like that. These were some comments that you were saying at the time. So, and it was all around your teammates being more loved in your country. So it was Arnoux at the time, and he was more loved in the country, even though you were much better and you were right in many incidents. Can you explain a little bit how tough that situation was?
I think this quote arrived after in 82, after the French Grand Prix, no? Is because I really discovered a strange thing that I never experimented before. I could not think about that. Because in fact, in 82, when we were, you know, we were fighting with the BMW engine, so I did not ask anything. And the team manager and the president of Renault at the time, Mr. Anand, they came in the motorhome and they asked René, because I was leading the championship, he said, we're going to give you more boost on the engine and to fight with the Brabham. And then if they stop, because they were really like this with the reliability of the engines, if they stop and you are first and second, Alain should win the rest and you leave Alain winning the rest because that's part of the deal. He said, yes, no problem, do it like this. Then it happened exactly what we have expected. The Brabham fell and then we were first and second. They show him the board and he refused to lead the way. For win, okay, but could understand, but I would have preferred that he would say, no, for win, I mean, I don't want to do that, you know. But the most important is not only losing the race and maybe losing the championship, because that was part of the history, but it's the reaction of the people inside the team and mainly outside, especially on the public. You know, I'll tell you a fun story. I came back, I was living in Saint-Chamond, the small city close to Saint-Étienne. Came back in the evening after leaving the Paul Ricard. I stopped on the fuel station. You know, at the time we had a fuel card, you know. So I stopped the station and the guy was there and I had the card in hand. He recognized me. I thought he recognized me. He said, oh, I saw you the race and, you know, I was very upset and whatever. I said, oh, yeah, wait, are you happy? I said, no, I'm not happy. And the guy said, but you know, this Prost is a you know? how can you leave the way or things like this? I had the card in my hand. I put the card in my pocket. And I said, okay. And I understood. And from this moment, it's only one day, but it has been a disaster. And I could not understand that the justice, you know, is on the other side, you know, because I did not never ask anything. And I had some problems in France. And that is from this period, I have decided to move to another country.
And they even put your cars on fire, you know, in front of your house. And it was exactly. A total mess. But and how did you deal with that personally, that this unfair hatred that came towards you, even though you were in the right and you never did anything wrong? They just happened to love the other driver more in that case. But how did you deal with that and rebuild yourself or get through this phase personally?
It was one of the most difficult because I always think about that. I had the same experience in 89 with Ayrton, in fact, at Imola, you know. So I had that twice in my career. And twice I have suffered about that in a big way. It's very difficult on the human side. Okay, people, they don't know me very well, but I'm very straight. You know, I'm very straight. Sometimes maybe too much, but for these kind of things, for the justice, for the word, if you give the word to somebody, if you, I am very, very straight, and I could not accept that. But at the end of the day, you say, okay, in fact, the people around you, they are not like this, you know? And how can you handle that, you know? So in fact, you have to, you know, to go back to the people that you love and they love you, and you have to friends, and you separate more the people, but you have to live with the media, with the press. I mean, very lucky that we did not have the social media at the time, because it would have been a disaster.
But that's nice how you say to regroup as well and re-find your own confidence. You go to search for those people that are close to you and that love you, and the close friends, the people who are separate from this chaos. That's a very nice thought and thing to say.
Difficult, but you know, for many, many years, I never read any newspaper, because I did not want to read anything. And I have, as you said, I mean, two cars in front of me. I had some messages before every race on my answer machine, you know, and you're going to kill you, you're going to things. And I was really afraid, you know, at one stage. It was really, it went over the top for nothing, you know, for nothing, for no reasons, you know. It was really, really tough.
And you had the same exactly again in 89, where the majority was on Senna's side, even though again, but is it possible to enjoy the sport still then in these moments, or is it just zero enjoyment?
You enjoy less, and that is the most difficult. You always are in balance in your head and in your heart. Say, okay, I love my sport, I love my business. It's very important to have your team close to you, you know, even some mechanics, you know, how it is, you know, you need to have a few people. But very often you say, okay, why do you do that? I mean, how can you do it? Why you do it, and how can you do it at 100% if you're not psychologically, you know, at the top? Because at the end of the day, you need the public, you need the people to support you, you know. I mean, if you have a football match, and if you are in house or outside, you don't have the same, and it's exactly the same for us. Even if we are in the car with the helmet, they don't see you, but we need to have the support, you know. I mean, you drove at Monaco like me. When you're in Monaco and you can feel the people there, the cheers for you, you know, and you can see the people even when you're driving. It gives you more confidence, it gives you more power, you know. And if you start to have some doubt about it, for sure your performance can be a little bit less. So it's very difficult mentally. And that was my biggest problem almost all my career, for sure.
Well, we all have that problem. Huh? It's a basic human need. Huh? Our basic human need is we need to be or feel significant. And that means that we have acceptance from people around us, and in our case as sportsmen, from the larger public and our team as well. It's something that is just unavoidably important for us as a human, and that makes it very unstable. And I give you an example of my career as well. For me, one of the most traumatic experiences, I was in Monza before the race. We were fighting for the championship as well with Lewis. And I was in the pit lane, and we were doing signing session just before the race on a Sunday morning. And I hear quite a few people, boo, 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 you know, towards me. Many people were cheering, but of course, some of them were also booing. And then I turn And I look to where this booing is coming from. And you cannot believe what I see. I see a beautiful four-year-old blonde girl on the dad's arm with hatred in the face towards me, angry, boo, boo, like this. And I'm next to her because I was signing for the person next to her. I get goosebumps still now. It was so such a terrible experience. And the dad had told her that I am evil, you know, because they were, of course, Hamilton fans and I am evil. And she was 4 years old. She had hatred in her face towards me. And boy, I mean, that is just, it's so tough to deal with that situation, especially if there's a situation where you know that you haven't done anything wrong. Of course, I also did mistakes and everything, but in this situation then, I hadn't done anything wrong. Wow, that is so hard to handle that.
That's a question I wanted to ask you, but very often I've seen some fans, you know, like Senna's fans or whatever, and I try to discuss with them, you know, because said, you know, you can be a fan of a team or you can be a fan of a man, but why do you hate me? You just ignore me or be the fan of the guy that you like or you love. I can understand that it's good for the sport. Why you want to hate me, you know? Because sometimes, as I said, I was a little bit afraid. And when you see the anger, it starts to be difficult because, as I said at the beginning, we are all human, but it's a human sport. You know, we are not talking enough about the human side of our sport and the teams and there are a lot of people there. But when you start to have the anger in the eyes of the people, that is really, really difficult. But we are not only you and me. I suppose we have a lot of cases like this. And then we have a racist problem today in the sport. And you can have these kind of things. It's more or less the same, you know. And it's increasing. You know? But again, difficult. And I can imagine what you have suffered also on your side. It was really, really difficult, you know. Because at the end, I always come back to the psychology, you know, it's very difficult to be in a team with a teammate like you had with Lewis, myself, with Ayrton, and even with other. If you are not at the top inside your team, and if you feel that I'm not talking about preference or things like that, because it's very marginal, you know, because very often it's only just a small detail that can put you in on a downside, you know. I remember when I was looking at the engines, you know, coming from Japan, and it's written on the engine, special for Ayrton, you know? And what does that mean? What does that mean? I never imagined that it could have 10 or 20 or 30 or far more. But if you start to have the doubt in your head, looking at that, you have lost already, you know, psychologically, is it why that, you know? It's all these kind of things. It's a succession of details. Things that human, not human, technical, and you know, you arrive at Monza, for example, in '89 when I had a T car and for Ayrton, and we had 40 people on the side and 4 people on the other side. You know, said, you know, it cannot work like this. You know, that is difficult. When Toto asked me, I remember a few questions about you.
I was gonna mention this because I know from Toto that one of the greatest learnings from him before going into this battle of Lewis against me was something that you told him, which you can share.
Yeah, I told him a few things. I don't remember exactly, but I remember very well that I said, never, never show to one or the other, whatever it was, that you have a preference or you could have a preference or you, I mean, just try to stay, you know, the same with both of them. I mean, don't put one or the other in a difficult position psychologically. Then you're going to have, obviously, if you do that, then the one down is going to try to find some tricks or you know, play a game or whatever. Then you start the thing. Also, the entourage, you know, that the people around you, around the riders, they can also play the game in this case, you know. Otherwise, that is only a small, I mean, naive advice, but I think it was good. I don't know if it works inside the team because you cannot see what happened inside.
Tricks and games? I don't know what you're talking about, Alain.
No, yeah. No, but I'm not going to answer about tricks or games because I never played these things, but you want to be the best in your team. So you have, you know, for example, when I was at Ferrari, Nigel always said, I am political, you know. You know why? Because I was talking Italian, but I always talk Italian from the go-kart, you know. And when you are at Ferrari, people, they speak Italian to you. You know, he did not want to participate to the briefing. He was playing golf and then coming back, and he was upset when I was speaking Italian until 9 or 10 o'clock. So he said, that is politic. He said, I'm trying to do the best. I'm trying to be world champion with Ferrari, you know. So I do, I play my own game. I mean, it's, so you see the difference between two drivers. It can be, it's not tricks, you know, but you need to get the best. I mean, if you're in a team like Mercedes or yourself, tricks, I don't think you can have tricks. I mean, on the track, possible, you know, but outside, I mean, especially in a team, a strong team, you just play your game and try to do the best. And also the ambience inside the team, if the people, they want to, they love to work for you, it's obviously easier. Some drivers, I met some drivers in my career, especially met where problems inside the team also because they did not galvanize, you know, they don't motivate the people, you know, but it's also a human side. It's very complex, in fact. Huh? It's not easy.
But you did mention Toto, so he really did try to follow your advice. And we ended up having a contract that both drivers had to sign. And believe me, there was many, many zeros on this contract. And zeros not being paid, but having to pay zeros. There was it was a big number. And it was, if we have a crash, it doesn't matter whose fault it is. Both are penalized. This was towards the end of our relationship. And it worked. It worked because you understand that you just need to be a little bit more careful because the penalty is going to be very, very large and both will have to pay it. So he definitely tried to listen. Unfortunately, you didn't tell that advice to all the other leaders within the team because they didn't listen to that so much. So that became more complicated then.
I don't want to comment that, but I know it's difficult to have two drivers, you know, for fighting for the championship in a team. You know, I know how difficult it is, but anyway.
Let's jump back. I want to jump back because I think it's quite inspirational. You got the nickname Professor very, very quickly in your career. And there was the story where you were very young, you were first in Renault, and suddenly you decided from yourself to transform the way the tires were going to put on your car. And you won the race. And so take us through how powerful it is to really think outside the box and have courage to also try to innovate and push. You know, this was your greatest strength.
The philosophy I had the first year in Formula Renault said, okay, we are 25 or 30 drivers. We all have the same car. There's two philosophies. First one, say, okay, I am the best. I'm the quickest. I'm the best. I'm going to beat them, you know, easy. Or second one, my philosophy, we have the same car. I may be the best, but I'm not sure. I need to make everything that I can improve my performance. So the one I realized that was the easiest and very interesting because I've always been very motivated and interested by that. I want to understand how the car works perfectly. And then I want to set up the car the way I want for my style. So when I arrived in Formula One, you know, we had, with Michelin at the time, we had the three type of tires, which I would always recommend to the Formula One management and FIA for many, many, many years, you know. But we could manage the tires the way we want. That was a freedom, you know. So we had a quantity of tires. I've tested myself how it could work with our tires on the left, soft on the right, and sometimes only one tire, sometimes. And then I could set up the car the way I want. But you cannot do that without having the experience of how to set up the car. It's not that easy. So to make the story short, I've decided to do this way. And the guy from Michelin, Pierre Dupasquier, said, no, you can't do that. It's not going to work. And said, let me do. I know what I'm doing, you know. And I've done that. And I think I won maybe at least 7-10 races like this with different tires, you know. And I mean, obviously, after a lot of drivers, they went more or less the same way. And that's why the guy said, you're a professor. That came from this moment.
I can relate to that also, to the importance of doing 100% on the preparation and really like innovate and think outside the box. But for me, it was very much driven by self-doubt and also the fear of failing. Because I think, maybe I'm not good enough and I don't want to lose. So I put every effort I could into preparation to perfection. You mentioned a little bit, were you driven by this self-doubt as well?
50%. And the strange things for me, the other 50% it could seem funny for you. It's the pleasure of doing by myself, getting the car better or finding new ideas, And in my career, I've done a lot of things that people do not know, But for example, bringing a guy I knew to make the car, the polish, to get to see if the car was quicker in the straight. And I've been, I realized that was in the late 80s, when you had a gearbox and we have a clutch, obviously. And after 1 hour, I realized that in racing, during the race, that your movement, with the legs was a little bit slower. Because it's the blood, especially when we had, the feet, going down. And I called a guy that I know was the world champion of ski downhill, Michael Frufer, French guy. He was studying, the phlebolog. The term phlebolog, the blood in the legs. So we experimented the bas de contention.
In the leg, I think, or something like that.
Yes, and that's what we can see with all sports guys today. And that was in 89 or 90. That was more than 30 years ago. And I rest with that. But I was hiding this kind of thing. I've done a lot of tests with Ron Poulenc also for the heart, for the neck, for the vision. And my helmet was a little bit wider than everybody that I did not mention at the time because... when I've done some tests for the vision, I realized when you have a wider things, you have a much better perception of, you see that doesn't make a difference, but it makes a difference in my experimentation I've done. I've done a lot of things to get things better. And I was also very interested by that because you always learn. But, I could tell you many, many stories that you could not believe, but I was always looking for new things, new tricks in this way.
You said that you don't do tricks. You're full of tricks, Alain.
That's why I come back to tricks because I prefer this kind of tricks.
Positive, of course. But I didn't mean bad tricks, mean tricks. No, positive tricks, and you forget to tell the others.
Yeah, exactly. I did not want to tell anybody. I did not want to tell for sure because that was my experience and I wanted to get the benefit of it. That is.
I had a black helmet because the paint on the helmet I found out was 80 grams.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure.
So I take off the paint because 1 kilo in our day, 1 kilo was 0.03 of a second per lap. Yeah. So 0.03 of a second per lap was just the paint.
Exactly.
So come on, and I have I have 50 examples like that, just like you. So I can really relate with that.
In our time, it was much less precise in this sense, and we had to do it by ourselves. We had to find the things by ourselves. And slowly it came to the, more people, engineers, and people there. They can advise you, and it's very, very different to that.
Alain, I have a really, really big, please. We're already now at 15. Please give me a little bit more time and move your meeting there or something, please.
Okay, no problem. I'll give you 10 more minutes.
No, please, Alain, come on. We haven't even touched on some of the most important things. Please, okay, you're putting pressure on me now. Okay. No, please, we need a little bit more time. 87, Alain, 87, you're at McLaren and they want to take Piquet. And you're like, no, take Ayrton. And you say, because it's better for the general interest of the team. But what are you, like a charitable foundation or what's going on here? Like imagine Lewis Hamilton getting asked from Toto today, do you want Raikkonen for next year or Verstappen as your teammate? I can tell you, he's not going to say Verstappen. He's going to say Raikkonen because he will. That ensures a calm situation in the team. It ensures that he can win all the year. He can be world champion. And you tell the team, for the general interest of the team, take Senna. He's the best. I mean, are you crazy or what?
That is my naive side, and that is also the fact that I loved the team at the time. I loved the sport. I loved the, you know, I mean, I could not imagine that would happen. But when you're talking about 87, in 86, we have been with Ron in Japan to get the engine for 87 already. Every time we had a discussion with the engine manufacturer or sponsors, I was going with Ron. I was almost like a partner. We were talking about shares in team. I was very close friend to Mansour also. McLaren at the time was my family. So we have been to Japan. I remember we had the long meetings at 3 o'clock in the morning in the room with all the Japanese people that were smoking from 86 to 87. Then we had another discussion. And I remember very well, we were in a room with the Japanese and we're talking about Nelson. I said, okay, because I was a good friend of Nelson, very good friend. said, but why Nelson? Because the new generation, the future is Ayrton, you know? So, and they all look at me, the Japanese, Ayrton, you want Ayrton? They were very surprised, you know? And I could say no in my contract. I mean, with Ron, I could say no. Say yes, but I think it's best for the team. I was only looking about the best for the team. Okay, that was a disappointment, considering the after what happened, you know. But I don't want to enter too much into that. But I don't regret it, because at the time when you make a decision like this, when you do it for a good reason, you know. So there's no point to regret it.
Okay, so then Senna joins, and of course, I mean, we experienced it as well at Mercedes, this negative relationship spiral. For us, I mean, the spiral really started 2014, actually. So we'd done a whole year, 2013, and then started in 2014. And it's not the right moment to like go into any details, but I know exactly where the spiral started. And it was actually where one of us did something where the other thought that it was on purpose, but actually it was not on purpose. And it was an accident, a minor thing. And then that was then the engineers picked up on it, told the driver, hey, look what the other guy is doing. And then you just get influenced from the outside. And then you want to set it straight because, hey, that's not right. That's not fair. And then you build yourself up like that. And you then cross over into the gray area yourself as well. And then once you do that, the other guy sees that and it just spirals. It spirals and spirals and spirals and spirals out of control. So everything for us just started with one guy doing a minor thing, which was definitely like almost beyond the gray area, but not on purpose. And the other one and the whole team and the engineers thought it was on purpose. Do you remember how the beginning of that was? What kicked it off that it spiraled so out of control?
It is very, very easy. Let's put 88. That was a fantastic season, except one or two places like Portugal when he put me in the wall and was a little bit tense and tough. He won one more race than me. I could have won Hungary, you know, when I overtook and, you know, one win is very one corner sometimes, you know. But on the sportive side, it was fair. Remember that he won one more race, but because of the rule at the moment, at this year, I had 12 or 14 points more than him. But okay, he wasn't a champion, no problem. I've seen the first test we have done in Imola. Ron asked me to drive the car first, and then when you drive the car first, you know, normally you need a little bit more laps because you have a lot of problems at the beginning you need to solve. And then after half a day, he said, oh, you need to leave the car to Ayrton. I said, but Ron, is not the plan because it's at the moment what I do is only one lap, two laps because there's a lot of things to fix. And I realized that, yeah, but Honda asked me that Ayrton has to drive. I said, Honda, I mean, you know, that was the first time. We are, you know, every time we had a pole position or we're fighting, you know, it was, we had a nice, no problem. 89, at the end of 88, I had a meeting in Switzerland with Mr. Kawamoto, the presenter of Honda. And I said to him, okay, I've seen a lot of things this year that is not fair. I've seen too much preference or too much, you know, the way the people behave at Honda. is too much for Ayrton. And I really feel, you know, I explained to him what I do with you, with a lot of people, the psychology inside the team. It was difficult for me to do, but it was, you know, and he said, I know, I appreciate that. My people are from the new generation and they like, they prefer the young guy and, you know, then you are like, he has a panache and you are the computer, you know, more or less. I did so. 89 was worst. That is for sure. But when arrived the Imola, and Imola was the key of everything, you know, when we had the agreement, and we have done this agreement minimum four or five times before, you know, but with the agreement, we always do this agreement in front of somebody. It was Ron, and John Hogan was there in the motorhome. After the rest, we had a meeting in Pembrey in Scotland when we were testing. And Ron came and said, I want to see you. And he said to Ayrton, what happened? You know, you had an agreement and it's... But when Ron was talking to Ayrton, he was never strong. He was really, you know, almost shy, you know. Ayrton said, but it's Anna overtook me before the first corner. He said, Ayrton, you know, we have 700 million people, you know, looking at the rest. How can you say that? You know, it was almost convincing his head that I overtook him. You know, so we had a strange discussion. And I've done a mistake. Because he was destroyed. Ayrton was destroyed. And I've told the story to a friend of mine who was a French journalist. And he put it on the newspaper. No, I've done a mistake, but I did not do it on purpose. We were very often talking off, you know, that we could do that at the time. And then he has not accepted that. That is why he has stopped talking to me and we had a sort of a war, you know, which was maybe completely different than the people can think why we had this, you know, but the end of 89 was really a nightmare for me, really, really a nightmare.
And when talking about differences mentally between you two, you've said that Ayrton would create his own truth, but which came from a lot of inner self-confidence. And so he would create his own truth, which satisfied his inner confidence that it was not his fault, but it was someone else's fault. And you gave the example that it was obviously him overtaking you in Imola and breaking the agreement. And he was so convinced that actually you overtook him and broke the agreement. And then... But after you said that after a while of discussing, he realized that actually he was wrong and he started crying. Is that right?
Yeah. He's cried a little bit. I didn't want to tell to say that. Yeah, he cried a little bit, and that's why he has he did not accept that it was you know in the newspaper the 2 days after. You know, yeah. He was really strange and he was different. Ayrton was really different to any other driver that I met. You know. And this side, it was really, but that is why also he was so confident about himself, you know. Ayrton was, qualifying. I almost did not try to fight in qualifying. It was so intense, you know, for qualifying on one lap. It was really could take any kind of risk. And but yeah, he was self confident, and he could not accept that we put this confidence in danger, in a way, you know, and that is why I, you know, you see what I said about the film Senna, I did not like, because when this story and the 2 years I've done and after what the fight we had, and then when I retired and the last 6 months before his accident, I completely realized that how he changed. He did not have this motivation. Motivation was really based on myself a lot. Not completely, but a lot. And also he lost his sort of self-confidence, you know, and he was not the same. He was not the same at all, you know. So he, in fact, in a way, he was trying to build this carapace, you know, to be at the top. And without that, he was a little bit more fragile. But I've seen a different driver, a different man after the November 93.
But if you had to compare yourself, the strengths, would you say that he was then mentally stronger than you were? Would that be something that you would say? And because of the self-doubt, you had more than that forced you to work harder and that became your strength to prepare more? Would you compare it like that?
I would say that he was, he had 110% commitment, you know.
But you also? And
yes, but I was too much in love for the sport, too much in love for all the things. I had already children. I had a family. You know what it is was a little bit different, you know. You okay, when I say 100% for him, it's because I was 100%. I was 100%, but he was even more. You know, I mean, the different subject we are going to understand. We are in a motor show in Geneva. I invite Ayrton, that was in 88. I invite Ayrton at home. My home is about 30 kilometers away from Geneva. We had a lunch, you know. Go in the car, does not talk very much to me. We have lunch. My wife was there, talk a little bit, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then he goes in, and then he had a nap. And then we go back to the show, and then he had another nap in the car. I said to the Honda guy in Switzerland, his good friend, I said, you know what happened? I explained to him that we could have had a nice, time. He said, yeah, but Ayrton told me. I said, what did he say? He said that he went to your home and a nice lunch and things like this, but he did not want to talk to me because he doesn't want to be a friend. You know? This commitment is you know, you were talking about your dad in 96. Ask him all the evenings we had a nice time and ask him. I mean, Nicky was 2 years with Nicky was maybe, I've never been like this in nightclubs and have nice parties and, but we were professional, very professional, unbelievable, you know. But we could have fun, we could have a relation, you know. I mean, for me, it was not a problem to have a good relation with Ayrton. I had a relation with the family, but he did not want, you know. He was really, the commitment it was so strong that he wanted me to be to have a separate. I was his goal, his motivation, and he could not do that.
But isn't that a weakness if you make it so extreme?
I think it could have been a weakness after I retired, maybe, because he lost a little bit some, but it was not a weakness when he was fighting with me, because he had support from the team. He has a big, huge support from Honda and huge support from the press, from the media and from the public. So it cannot be a weakness, or it's more strength, you know, because when Ayrton say, you know, this, you have a red pullover, I can see it blue, but he was convinced that it was red. And some people could say, oh, yeah, maybe he's right. Maybe red, you know. No, is that you remember the press conference? I mean, you don't remember, but press conference in Monaco when I think 88 or 89, I don't remember.
Sorry, I was 2 years old.
Exactly. So I tell you the story because it's you have some journalists they're still involved in Formula One. They were there at the time, you know, when Thursday was quickest, Friday was not, Saturday morning quickest, you know, and Saturday qualifying, we had 4 sets of tires. The first 3 sets I was the quickest, and the 4 sets he beat me by 2/10, 3/10, you know, and at press conference, we go together. The journalist said, oh, Alain looks to be much quicker than you. And then suddenly, the last qualifying set, you beat him. What happened? He said, you know, it was took time before we answer. He said, oh, I've decided after the tunnel that I move myself from the car. And I look at the car. Going around the track, and I realized what I had to do, and I came back to the car, put the four set, and then beat them. I was sitting beside him, and I said, that's going to be, you know, a disaster. It's going to be, you know, the press, the media is going to... And nothing. Only in the press, I've seen a mystic press conference, you know? And we are talking very often to some journalists. They were there at the time. I said, why these things, you know, they did not went out? Because at least you could understand how he could feel, how good he could be, you know. And can you imagine when you are, if you put in my situation, you know, I said, okay, this guy can say anything, is going to be supported. So you are in a weaker position all the time. You know, so that is that's part of the story. Yeah,
but it's a total course. No, I can relate with that. But that's a strength of his then to create his brand, to create his aura. Because you can play the media and you play the public in that way, and it gives you extra strength.
On the other side, I must say that you have the evolution. But when I was with John Watson the first year, I had a preference, you know. When I was the second year with Nikki, first year was the 50-50, but I had a preference. When I was with Stefan, I had a preference. When I was with your dad, as soon as they realized that your dad was not, you know, I had a sort of preference. You can feel that sometimes, you know. So I must say that it can be both ways, you know. But he had the extreme situation with Ayrton because of the personality and because of the, you know, the whole media and public,
So you can relate a little bit with Sebastian Vettel's situation at Ferrari as well, where he starts off as being the god, and then there's the young guy who comes. It's so hard mentally, no?
It is very hard because you need to understand that you always, the young guy, especially if you have the talent, will always have the advantage because he has the advantage of being young, being the future of the team, you know? Even Ayrton and myself, we had 5 years difference, you know? But very often I heard about McLaren at the time, you know, with Honda. I mean, Ayrton is the future because for sure it's normal, you know. The problem is to the people on Formula One, they are not thinking enough on the human side. You're only two in the team, you know. And you have to protect also the guy that he has given to you a lot before. And if you are prepared to have a young driver that like Ferrari, you need to prepare also Sebastian for that. And you can always help. The worst thing is to put, the two guys in the middle of everything and support only one guy and degrade it, you know, the human side of the other guy. That is really difficult. And that happened very often in Formula One, I think.
Okay. Thank you so much, Alain, for giving the extension of time. I have one more thing, which for me gave me one of the biggest goosebumps, is that you told me that one of your regrets from the Senna movie at the end is that it doesn't show the forgiveness and the strong friendship, and as well how the Brazilian public sees you and receives you today. Can you just share with us, like, if you would go to Brazil now and you come to the track, do they boo you or do they celebrate you?
Now, I must say that is really a very good, what happened in my life today is obviously it's very related to when you speak about Ayrton, you speak about me and the opposite. And after what happened, they all know, understand what happened also, you know, and that is why the film is really a nightmare for me because I wanted to have the complete, you know, relation until the end because the last 6 months, if you understand the last 6 months, you understand everything what happened before. And I don't have any reproach or I don't think negative about this relation because it's part of the history. And that is why I'm also here, you know, because it's the popularity and whatever. But when Ayrton died, you know, before we had 50-50, you know, and people, 50, they love you, 50, they hate you, especially on my side. And I've had a lot of problems in France, a lot of problems in France, in my country, you know. When Ayrton died, we had a sort of the community, you know, they went together, you know. And it's, I have a connection with a lot of Brazilians and my Instagram, the most followers from far, they are in Brazil, you know.
That's crazy.
And then when I go to Brazil, it's like not my country, but I have no problem. I would never have a security guy in Brazil. Never, you know, because it's, I've been to Ayrton's house with the family. I'm still a member of the foundation. I'm still in contact with Vivian and Bruno, obviously, because it's part of the, you know, the history, as I said. And that's best because at the end, we come back to the human side. And that's what I wanted to show. Is more the human side for the last 6 months, calling me every week, but sometimes twice per week, you know, asking questions and things like this. So I know a lot of things from himself that I could never realize. And the family knows that. So slowly you can feel how it was. In fact, even if it was tough, you know, it was the human side was stronger than you think. You know?
But it's so nice to see.
I hope you have this the same thing with Lewis, maybe one day. You don't know.
Yeah, maybe one day. I would be open for that. Definitely.
Now, when you're older, you can see different things. And for me, I was not older. I mean, suddenly, in one moment, on the podium in 93, and after at a press conference, and after the press conference, I realized that something was absolutely, completely different, you know. And I could not believe that.
But maybe it requires one of us to do the first step of saying sorry, I guess.
Yes, because he told me many, many things, you know, that was not correct or whatever, what he had done, things like that. I understood that he has done it to beat me. When he was racing in go-kart, and after go-kart Formula 3, he was only looking about myself. How was his goal? I didn't know that. If the people, they don't show you or don't explain to you, then you see, oh, he has done that. Okay, it was very strange sometimes, but at the end, I was very proud also, you know, because he was, all his career was pointing to me, you know. When he called me the day after, 2 days after Australia in 93, saying, Alain, because I had already an offer from McLaren, you know, with a Peugeot engine. He said, oh, please come back, you know, I'm not motivated to other guys and motivating about yourself. And I lost my goal, I lost my motivation. You know, why are you telling me that? But I explained a lot after.
Did you also say sorry?
I said sorry about the article, the fact that I... Yeah. But I said sorry about that, but much before that, during the year, in 89. Yeah. I went to see him in the motorhome because we were talking in the motorhome when he did not talk to me anymore. Yeah. When we had a briefing, technical briefing, we were talking like if you were like your dad, like Nikki, like normal, absolutely normal. And I promise you that I never lied or I never hide something when we were in a technical briefing. And I must say that I'm sure, and I cannot be 100%, but I'm sure that he has not lied also himself on the technical side. After it was closed door. And one day I remember he came back to the motorhome and said, okay, Nathan, I want to tell you that I spoke off to my friend for 20 years. I'm sorry about what happened. I did not want to do it. I just want you to, but excuse me. That's the only time I did it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Alain. I'll call you to do the mediator. So when Lewis and I, we meet, you come and you do the mediation. Huh? You sit in the middle.
I want to be in the middle. That would be fine. Okay.
Thank you so much, Alain. Very, very interesting. Bye-bye. See you soon.
See you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.